Happy New Year, and welcome to this live broadcast of The Peace Frequency. The Peace Frequency is a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. And you can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. I am your host, Darren Cambridge, and throughout the month of January, the USIP Global Campus is offering the course Community-Based Peacebuilding, Engaging Youth. And I am joined in the studio today by Dr. Allison Malofsky and Dr. Mark Brimhall Vargas and our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis. Allison Malofsky is Director of Curriculum and Training Design here at USIP and is the main instructor in the Community-Based Peacebuilding course. So she will be co-hosting this show with me during the run of her course throughout January. So this is the first time you will hear her this month. So Allison, thanks for offering this course and thanks for being with us in the studio today.
My pleasure.
We're also, as I said, joined by Dr. Mark Brimhall Vargas. He is Deputy Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Maryland here in the United States. He has over 16 years of expertise in diversity management and programming, cultural competency, and conflict resolution at the University of Maryland. He has directed the Words of Engagement Intergroup Dialogue Program. He serves as an in-house expert on campus-wide organizational development and serves on a variety of campus-wide committees. So Mark, thank you for joining us here in the studio today, because I know you had to brave some snowy elements to get here.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And lastly, as always, we invite you, our many listeners tuning in online from around the world, to chime in with your questions and comments. And you can at any time connect with our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis. Vanessa, are you mic'd up? Can you say hello?
Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in.
Vanessa will be moderating your questions and comments and instant messaging you during the broadcast. And as I said, we really look to listeners like you to help us guide this conversation and engage with our guests. So anytime you have a question or a comment, notify Vanessa by clicking that little raise hand button on your control panel you should see on your screen. And you will get queued up so we can unmute you and bring you into the show, and you can share your question and comment directly. We would love to hear your voice. But if you do not have a microphone on your computer, you can also instant message Vanessa your question, and she will read it for you on air. So with that, let's get started. Now, Mark, we want to bring you up to speed in terms of what's been happening in the course so far.
Sure.
And Allison began the course with an exercise asking participants to introduce themselves with something called 3-2-1. So that is, what are three things that people might be surprised to learn about you? What are two things that you are passionate about? And what is one quote that you try and live by? So in all fairness, Allison and I and many of the participants have already responded to these questions and participated in this exercise. So now we pose these questions to you. So what are three things that people might be surprised to learn about you?
Well, I guess one of the things that I don't think I share widely, perhaps Allison, I don't even know if you know this. I have been playing the Celtic harp for about 15 years. Wow. Did you know that, Allison?
I have seen a picture of you doing it.
You have.
Celtic harp. What does that look? Does it look like a reggae?
It's about
quote unquote regular harp.
It's about as tall as you.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. So it's pretty big.
I'm about 6'3", just so our listeners online.
Maybe not that big.
Okay.
But it's pretty big. And I also I have 5 parrots at home and a 60-gallon aquarium at home. So I really love. I love my pets.
Nice.
And I guess one of the things that I really do often is I like to listen to a lot of popular books on audio.
Oh, nice.
One pastime of mine. So.
Nice. Excellent.
Two things I guess that I am passionate about is, one is voting. I have voted in every election that I've ever been eligible to vote for since I was 18. And it's a point of pride that I've never missed one. So I definitely always want to make sure that I do that. And I really appreciate spicy food. The hotter, the better. So oh, nice, I'm passionate nice. About good
food. Sriracha fan?
Absolutely. Yeah, all right. A quote I like to live by is one by Audre Lorde, which is, it's not our differences that divide us, but rather our inability to celebrate those differences. Sort of informs the work and the work that I do and how I try to approach that work.
And just out of curiosity on that quote, when did you first read that quote?
I came across that quote when I was in college, so which is a number of years ago, which I won't go into. I had taken a course that was about issues of equity. It was you're taking me way back. Dr. Lauren Foster taught a class called Race, Class, and Power. And that was one of the assigned readings way back in my undergraduate days.
Nice, nice. Well, moving on to this course that Allison has designed and is the main instructor, let's bring you up a little more to speed on what's being discussed this week in the course. And Allison, you've laid out some guidelines that shape the peace-building toolkit for educators. So I was hoping, could you briefly share with our listeners what these guidelines are and which of these guidelines do you see, Mark, helping us understand more deeply during today's show?
So there are three, the guidelines actually that are rooted in the toolkit or support the toolkit. There are a couple of major ones that I think really underscore the work that Mark does at the University of Maryland around dialogue. The first is that we have to really understand multiple perspectives in any situation that we come to. We each present unique perspectives and have our own truths. And then there's that key one that we want to be thinking and teaching dialogue skills. That's obviously the most relevant, that we have to understand the distinction between dialogue and debate and look at how dialogue can bring people together and open up places of possibility. And then there's also this notion of sharing stories. Dialogue is so much rooted in personal experience and emotion, which is really where stories are used to connect people and create empathy. So those are kind of the three that I think of off the top of my head that really support Mark's work.
Agreed. Absolutely.
And you two have worked together in the past. You've known each other for a while. So could you share with our listeners a little bit about what experiences have brought you two together to do this work around some of these guidelines that Allison has just laid out?
Sure. Well, Allison and I, we actually known each other for a number of years. We did our doctoral work together at the University of Maryland. We've facilitated dialogue together here in the United States and elsewhere. And we've just known each other for a long time. I often think of Allison as like, you know, in a past life, she was my sister, I'm sure. So
Excellent. So bring us up to speed on your work, Mark. You work at one of the largest and most diverse universities in the state of Maryland here in the United States. There's over 37,000 graduate and undergraduate students that are coming from over 120 countries. So given the environment in which you have been working, what are the main goals of your job at the University of Maryland as a Deputy Chief Diversity Officer? And what are you hoping to accomplish in this position?
Sure. So the University of Maryland established the Office of the Chief Diversity Officer about 5 years ago. And the Deputy Chief Diversity Officer, we both worked together to bring about the Diversity Strategic Plan, which is a 10-year plan that the institution has related to recruitment and retention of students, graduate students, faculty, staff, et cetera, in addition to research, in addition to climate, other concerns like that. And so our office, we lead other offices as well on campus on everything from making sure that students have adequate support to meet their academic needs to helping faculty diversify their departments if that's something that they would like to do, to setting forth larger diversity goals for colleges even in terms of how they want to move forward with programming or training or other endeavors like that. One of the things that we're really trying to do is move beyond what I call passive programming. Mm-hmm. Passive programming at universities is useful, and certainly we have to start there. It's the kind of programming where we have a speaker and someone shows up and they listen to the speaker talk. And that's sort of the passive experience of diversity education. We're trying to move, as the dialogue program is an example, into the kind of educational experiences that require more participation, require more self-reflection, require that sort of deeper looking within, but also connecting to other people in a way to augment their understanding of the reality around them. So we are providing resources to other entities on campus so that they can have their own dialogic experiences on whatever topics make sense around them in their particular area of campus. Because that next level of programming is where you actually, you know, you go that distance from the head to the heart. And it has to, at some point, the university, because it's so large, needs to sort of move that effort outside of the chief diversity officer's direct service.
Now, you work on a university campus community, so a lot of this work is situated and appropriate for that community. Allison, I'd love to hear from you. The title of your course is Community-Based Peacebuilding. What do you mean by community, or what are some other examples of community where the skills, the knowledge, and the ideas that are shared in this course can actually be put to use? You know, so obviously Mark has that campus community setting. What are some other community settings?
Well, when I think of a community, it's really thinking of any place where there are people who want to belong to something. I think that people inherently want to belong, to whether it's in a family, they want to feel a sense of belonging. And so community can be any group of people who, it doesn't have to be a town, it doesn't have to be a campus, but I think it's any space where people want to fit in. And so for me, it's about providing the skills so that when people in that community aren't all the same, which is hard to find, so that when people aren't all the same in that community, they can navigate those differences and appreciate those differences and communicate effectively across differences and, you know, find a way to enjoy each other more. So a community really could be any group of people who come together wanting to belong. So I think of, when I think of a community, I think of, and I, when I think of the skills, it could be at a very individual level. I'm thinking of a friend of mine who struggled to find and to feel a sense of belonging, a community based on her identity. So this is somebody who is biracial and didn't feel necessarily a part of either two communities. Neither of her communities wanted to accept her, and she really wanted to feel a sense of belonging. So for her, it would be helping her to figure out how to, when somebody says something that's offensive to her and that she doesn't belong, she's not Latina enough, that she can figure out how to use those dialogue skills and have a conversation to help that person understand, that person who she's taught with whom she's talking, understand what it means to her to belong and how the ways in which she is a part of that community. So I have a sort of a vague meaning of community for me. I don't think of one, there's not one set definition. It's a group of people with differences.
Well, Mark, you said something about how the work that you do kind of begins in the head and moves to the heart, if I heard you correctly. And then Allison, you really brought home this point about community is where folks want a sense of belonging. And I think these are, you know, laudable goals. And I also imagine that it involves a lot of sensitive work, difficult conversations like the one that you just talked about, Allison, and contentious issues and dynamics where that really draw out the differences that we may have amongst each other. So this work is no doubt it's filled with challenges and opportunities. So Mark, how and why did you get involved in this line of work, given all these kind of challenges and opportunities? And was there a specific moment in your life that you got interested in doing diversity or dialogue work?
Sure. Well, I will say that I didn't start doing diversity work. I don't think anyone actually says, okay, I think I'm going to get a job doing diversity work.
There's no like diversity work for dummies book.
Yeah, there's no diversity work for dummies there. And there are very few academic programs, for example, that are explicitly targeted to what I would call sort of a diversity profession. There are some that do sort of multicultural education work or perhaps policy work, which is how I entered. I entered because I had done as an undergrad and in my graduate work, I had really worked on policy as a as an academic focus. It ended up because of the concerns and lived experiences that I had, my policy concerns almost always had a diversity angle to them. So after I received my master's, I ended up working in several places, one that focused a lot on poverty issues, one that focused on Latino advocacy concerns, another position that also focused on general assistance programs, for example, which is another poverty issue concern. And I got to the University of Maryland with that sort of background and over time ended up taking on a task here, a responsibility there, that eventually became a career, the sort of, in some ways, a diversity on accident career. But what started that was a lifetime of experience. One of my earliest memories that I can recall of my parents, when I was born and raised in Albuquerque, I identify as biracial. My mother is from Peru. My father is here, white, from the United States. My mother attempting in Albuquerque at that time to get housing, and being told that the apartment wasn't available. But when my father attempted to get the same apartment, was able to obtain it. So early on, I had an in-home education around inequity, discrimination, and both of my parents being very ardent supporters for equity and social justice. That sort of was a normal conversation in my household. In college, of course, I became a part of a political sort of movement of the time. You know, I had worked on reproductive rights issues, LGBT issues. Divestment from South Africa was a concern that we sort of protested around at that time. So it just was something that always accompanied my concerns. You care about something, you do something about it.
Our on-air producer, Vanessa, has informed us that we have a question or comment from one of our listeners.
We do. We have a question from Jody Cambridge, and I'm going to aim this to you, Mark.
Okay.
The diversity discussion has moved beyond race and ethnicity, i.e. it's no longer about goals and timetables or affirmative action. It's now about inclusion of all groups. Has this movement to inclusion diluted the issues of institutional racism that have impacted Blacks and Hispanic people, and instead led us to a discussion about issues which are not germane to the majority Black and Hispanic Americans?
It's a great question, and it's a concern that I think is a part of the general conversation that takes place, say, for example, at diversity conferences. Many organizations that were originally established to, say, focus on particular issues of race have expanded their sort of network of concerns because the concept of diversity has broadened. I think, for example, that I think it's a false dichotomy, and let me tell you why I think that. At the University of Maryland, we have a very difficult history when it comes to issues of race. The University of Maryland actively discriminated against African-American people who existed right around them, right? Wouldn't admit African-Americans for a significant period of time. And now is in a very different place, right? That the University of Maryland, for example, fought to retain a race-based scholarship. We lost, but we really fought hard to retain that. Here's what I feel about that, and I don't have evidence for this. This is just sort of my general understanding. I think that the university is very much a place that we are moving in a direction of needing to understand the breadth of diversity, but we can't lose sight of the fact that race is a preeminent issue. And unless we get race right, we're not going to get these other things right. We have a faculty member at the University of Maryland named Julie Park. She's in the College of Education. A lot of her work has really focused on the need to make sure that race is still a central concern of diversity, because if you don't get race right, the impact on the educational benefits of diversity do not accrue or accrue as well if you attempt to proxy race with anything else, including things like socioeconomic class, which are, again, an important diversity issue. So absolutely, we have to make sure that race is still a central focus. And that we maintain that focus where it's necessary. But the reason I say it's a false divide is because by saying that we're only going to focus on race, well, there are LGBT people of color, right? There are people of color who are gender or sexual minorities. Socioeconomic class is tightly correlated with race, right? If we attempt to divide them, we, in fact, are marginalizing the very people that we say we're concerned about. So it is more complex thinking. It is harder to do that. I'm not saying that it's easier. But we see that the activists that are emerging now around, Black Lives Matter, Ferguson, et cetera, they are bringing together a very wide alliance of people. Why? Because they recognize that it is in those particular margins and intersections that the most silenced people are finally finding voice. So I think, is race important? Yes. Is everything else important? Yes. And I also think that we have to get race right, and we have to get it right first, because I think if we don't get race right, everything else falls apart.
Mm-hmm. Now, Allison, one of the main topics this week in your course is around dialogue. And what is dialogue? How is it different and distinct from debate? And Mark, you're talking about getting race right. You're talking about this idea of inclusion and how there are multiple voices and perspectives, not just around race, but around socioeconomic class, gender, etc. And what I'm hearing is that dialogue can be a process that helps groups get to getting race right, but then also having that inclusive conversation. So I pose this question to both of you, because you're doing dialogue work in similar but also different contexts. What is dialogue for you? Let's start with you, Allison. What is dialogue for you, and how do you define dialogue?
Well, I try to distinguish between dialogue as a process and dialogue as an approach. So dialogue, there are many types of dialogue. The form of dialogue that I know as a process is it's called intergroup dialogue, and it's a specific method of sustained interaction between people of different backgrounds around an identity. So it might be around race or ethnicity, it might be around gender and sexuality, it could be around many different things, but you're bringing people together in an inclusive process and over a sustained period of time to build understanding and build relationships. And so really it's not about, and what distinguishes it from other processes is that it's about how you engage. So you can bring people together, have the same exact group of people in a discussion, and what they're going to come out with is going to look different and feel different than if that group of people is engaged in a dialogue. And so it's a sustained process and it's an inclusive process, but it's a process that is rooted in emotion. It is rooted in experience. And it's something that privileges that personal experience. And that's how people begin to learn and understand that not everybody lives the way I live and experience the world, or the way they live and experience the world. So it's understanding and becoming informed of other realities, not for the purpose of saying, oh, okay, that exists, and now I'm more informed, and I'm going to go on with my life. It's listening to people for the purpose of taking it in and rethinking and re-examining one's own ideas. So it's distinct from other. It's not that we're going to agree to disagree at the end of the day. It's what does it mean for me? What does your reality and your truth mean for me if this is my reality? How does your reality inform my understanding of the world?
Yeah, Mark, what about you? What does dialogue mean to you, and how do you define it? Is it different, similar to what Allison has shared?
Well, Allison and I think we agree on a lot, because we, not everything. I think it's important to understand that Allison and I do disagree about some things. But on the definition of what is dialogue, clearly we see this in a very similar way. I think one of the things that Allison is pointing to is that there is no single definition. And so we're building an understanding of what dialogue is based on our experience. There are some pieces to it that I think are really important, though. I mean, there has to be some type of the goal is more about understanding and not really convincing people, right? That when one enters a conversation in dialogue, the goal is not that I have to impress upon you my truth and my understanding, but rather I'm going to really work hard to try and understand where you're coming from. That is a very different attitudinal shift than we would see in a discussion or a debate. I also see dialogue as something that fundamentally relies on, you know, what Paulo Freire calls problem-posing pedagogy, right? That it is something that instead of saying things or having more statements, that in fact it's more that we're asking questions and really paying attention to what we're hearing as an answer. That when we actually see, hey, we have this particular problem, what might our perceptions be of it? That's where we really learn about ourselves and each other. And that on some level that it has to be informed, right? That dialogue also has to be in some ways connected to lived experience and connected to other information around us, so that it isn't just about my opinion or my conjecture. is somehow going to be something that frames our reality. It should inform how we see something, but it isn't going to encompass everyone else.
Mm-hmm. So I'll pose this question to our listeners online. If you have any experience participating in or facilitating a dialogue process, we'd love to hear what your experience has been like and how you define dialogue based off of these experiences. And I'll pose this question actually to you, Allison, and Mark as well. What was your first exposure to something that somebody or some group called dialogue? And how did you come then to develop and understand dialogue in the way that you just described it? Because Allison, you said that there are many forms of dialogue, intergroup being one of them. So obviously that begs the question that there are, what are the other forms of dialogue? So what were your first exposures to dialogue, and how did you come to the kind of intergroup dialogue process or model?
So let me start by answering the second one in some
ways.
I work with sort of, and this is painting with a very broad stroke, right? That there are two basic kind of approaches to dialogue. One that I call the democracy model. And there's, you know, the literature does talk about this democracy model, one that's called the social justice model. And they tend to sort of, they do different things and they serve different functions. They have strengths and weaknesses, each one. And to the extent that I can, I try and pull from the best parts of both models, depending on whatever the needs are of the particular participants. The democracy model is one that really focuses on process. And the process is preeminent. So a facilitator in a democracy model is only going to facilitate what the participants want to talk about. Very rarely will contribute any different context, won't really raise the perspectives of people who are not present, sees him or herself as being very much neutral, if you will. The social justice model is the opposite. The facilitator is someone who really focuses on content and process. So in addition to making sure that everyone can participate and that there's equity in the room, they'll also pose information into the room that may not be immediately brought up by the participants. They'll bring in issues of power or inequity. They'll raise those type of issues that may not be brought by the participants themselves. And almost rarely will a social justice facilitator almost never will say that they're neutral. They might say they're impartial. They might say that they're multipartial, meaning I want everyone to win, right? That kind of thing. But that this sense of neutrality is the tension that exists between these two models. The democracy model is very good at addressing things that are a crisis. So if there's immediate violence, for example, focusing on our common things that we have in common, our common humanity, only bringing up what people want to bring up, that's good to make sure that people aren't shooting each other, right? And it's good to help people feel good about some type of interaction that they might have because people are going to be very polite. The social justice model, though, I think is more also about building authentic relationships through that conflict. So democracy models will start to feel confining at some point when people are not able to address the very conflicts that exist among them. So in general, democracy models are good for short-term solutions, social justice model for longer-term solutions. But if we only focus on structure and power and inequity, we're also not focusing on building community, which is what a democracy model does fairly well, at least initially. Hmm. So those are the way that I think about it. And it's not that one application is right and the other is wrong, but rather you have to be very selective about why you're choosing the model that you're choosing at that time. And where did I see it? Well, at the University of Maryland, we had decided at some point to assess our own diversity programming. And we had learned that across the board, white students and students of color dislike diversity programming on campus.
How did you determine that?
Well, what we found out is that students of color felt that diversity programming on campus was all glitz, no substance. White students felt like we were shoving it down their throat. Mm. And everyone was dissatisfied with the sort of one-shot approach. It didn't feel like it actually sustained them beyond the moment. So we learned that we needed to do something that was more sustained. We brought in experts from Arizona who were using the University of Michigan's intergroup dialogue model to teach us how to do it at Maryland. And that started in the year 2000. And we've been doing it ever since.
That's great. Allison, we have a question from one of our listeners.
Yes. Mark, again, for you.
Yeah.
What would a diversity action plan look like? Beyond the dialogue, what would be some concrete actions that a university or a large public or private institution take so that it can be certified as diverse?
Well, I don't know what certified as diverse means, so I'm concerned about any sort of particular threshold as being sort of the line at which someone is arrived. But things that I would certainly say should be a part of any implementation plan where diversity concerns are preeminent, certainly a climate assessment and a robust one. So a sense of what are the lived experiences and perceptions of people at all levels of the institution, recognizing that it can't just be a survey, right? Because if, for example, you have, which we do, staff who don't speak English or don't have access to a computer, you know, you have to be thinking about how do we collect and assess the climate of the campus, and then the commitment to actually do something about whatever that climate assessment says. We have to be thinking about recruitment and retention. For a university, it's very important that we start with faculty. I think that because faculty have by far the most power in the institution and shape the experience that students cannot avoid, class, right? So if the research that faculty bring and the faculty themselves are diverse, the experience on students is impacted regardless. So those are things that I think would be top of my list. We want to make sure that we're recruiting and retaining a diverse faculty who themselves perhaps may need some help and preparation in preparing a more multicultural curriculum. So those are places where I would definitely start.
And yeah, I mean, you raised, our listener raised a good question, and Mark, you shared some valuable things. It'd be good to hear from other folks who are listening online what their experience has been around whatever communities or workplaces or schools or colleges or universities, if they feel like those are communities that are intentionally supporting a work around diversity and work around inclusion, or if they feel like that's lacking. It'd be great to hear some of those experiences. Allison, I'd like to go back to you with a question about your first exposure to dialogue and kind of what got you passionate about doing this work in the first place.
So diversity work and dialogue they come together through in intergroup dialogue because that's rooted in identity. And we at Maryland, we certainly focus on identity, and the work that I do with USIP dialogue is around identity. My diversity focus actually stems from my Peace Corps experience in Slovakia and teaching at a university. Teaching at a university and having a fairly homogenous group of students who, and not just my students, but in all aspects of my life there in Eastern Europe, really struggling with perceptions of the Roma population and the stereotypes of them and the desire to keep them in conversations, people's desire to keep them on the outskirts of society, and me being frustrated as an educator with not being able to have productive and constructive conversations with my students. And that was the moment where I really, the life experience, everything that led up to it crystallized for me. And when I left the Peace Corps, I said, this is the work that I need to do. I'm leaving the classroom and I'm focusing specifically on combating prejudice and reduction. And I fortunately was able to work for an organization managing the education training programs that did just that, anti-bias education. That's what led me into the content. Dialogue was the process to really be effective in having those conversations. Prior to that, I would say that it was very much of a discussion process. So I left teaching and came to an organization where we had conversations, engaging young people in these really difficult, challenging conversations around identity, high school, middle school, and high school students, still very much discussion-based. That sort of the, okay, we get it, yeah, uh-huh, you have that opinion, and we're okay, I respect your opinion, but at the end of the day, we agree to disagree. And my entree into dialogue and really understanding how to get deeper was really through the University of Maryland in 2003. I was invited to co-facilitate an interfaith dialogue. And I began to see how, so it was this incremental process for me of getting to that place where I could really take the diversity piece and that social justice piece that was so comfortable for me and important for me and really was passionate about and really finding the tools to effectively engage people in those conversations that matter.
And Allison's being very humble. She's now one of our veteran facilitators. She's our go-to person.
You
and I'm old. That was 2003, so I've been there a while doing that.
You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus. And today in the studio, we are joined by Dr. Allison Milofsky and Dr. Mark Brimhall Vargas, and we're talking about dialogue and diversity work in a variety of different communities and settings. So I'm thinking about the participants in the course, those who want to walk away at the end of this month, at the end of this journey with some skills to do this kind of work in their communities. And so what are some of the biggest challenges that you all have faced as you began doing this work and as you continue to do this work that would be helpful for learners to hear about so that they may maybe avoid some of those obstacles or, you know, be prepared?
Sure.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. One of the things, and I'm mindful of the answer I just gave to the previous question, you know, about a climate assessment, for example, I call this the data problem. A colleague of mine and I, Dr. Christine Clark, she's a professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. We've written a lot about this problem called the data problem. And what that means is that there are often trends and experiences at universities where the university decides that they need to collect information about diversity as a problem. Whatever's not going right, we have to figure that out. And that when you research and look into it, there's either the problem of we don't have enough information, we need more information. So there's this perpetual desire for data, which is good. I mean, but there's not really movement. Or we don't really know anything because we don't like the data, we don't like the methodology, we don't like the person who's due. Like, there's always an excuse to not actually move forward. That's our data problem. One of the things that we also find is that there is a sense that diversity is something that everyone knows everything they need to know about already, and that there isn't an academic preparation that one can undertake and have expertise in the field. So, for example, I don't go to a physics professor and tell them how to do their job, but everyone has an opinion about diversity and feels entitled to it as though they bear expertise. And so what ends up happening is that we end up having to educate the people who feel as though they are already experts in that field, even though some of the things that they're doing or saying are highly problematic. Mm-hmm. So it's about cultivating allies and also being patient with potential allies, the people who maybe aren't saying all the right things but are movable, and making sure that you spend the time to cultivate them.
That's great. We have a question from an audience member.
The question comes in from Amani, and I'll leave it open to Allison or our guest. Do you think that we need to go through several steps before bringing people from the conflicted parties in a community into dialogue, keeping in your mind that the community can present students, women, community leaders, and should we have to tell them that we are using dialogue as a tool for peace building? Specifically, this person is interested in the techniques that we can use in the dialogue process.
I would say that when people come into a dialogue process, I believe in transparency. I think that that's an important element of dialogue, and so that people should know what they're being invited into, and people should be willing participants. And to be a willing participant, you have to know what you're entering into. You have to know that it's a dialogue process. You have to know what is not necessarily that there's a roadmap, but you have to know. I think you should be aware of what the process is, not that there are guarantees, but that there is a plan. And if there isn't a plan, if the facilitators or those leading the process don't have a plan, then it can be problematic and it can backfire. So I do think that people should know. And I think that in preparing for it, one of the key skills that we actually don't get to in the toolkits is that it's an essential facilitator skill in dialogue, which is asking questions, asking. We've referred to it as the art of asking questions, and it's figuring out or developing the skill of asking the what and how questions and trying to avoid the why questions, not the why is the sky blue, but the questions to individuals. Why do you think that? Why did you say that? And really thinking through how we ask our questions of each other, being aware of what's underneath our questions, what's motivating us to ask our questions, and being aware of our intent. But there's also this challenging piece for facilitators in dialogue of avoiding leading questions, those questions in which we, as a facilitator or as somebody engaging in dialogue, where we have a bias, and that bias is communicated through our questions. So there are a lot of skills and concrete skills that you can actually develop to facilitate and lead dialogue. That's one side of it. The other side of it is, how do you get people in the room? That really goes back to whether it's the democracy model, the social justice model, or any other model.
Right.
Well, I want to. You said something about the art of asking a good question, and you reminded me of a conversation that you and I, Allison, you and I had just a couple of days ago when putting together the online course. And you had written very specifically how to ask this question to debrief an exercise. And I think the way that I had originally written was like, "Why did you make this choice?" And you said, "Well, there's another way to ask that question." So do you remember this conversation?
I do.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about that, because that was really enlightening for me about how you can ask a similar question, but it the way that you ask a question creates a different type of dynamic versus another way.
I'm actually going to turn it over to Mark, because I learned this from Mark.
Yeah, it's there is something about the word why that is really problematic, at least in English, and I suspect, and certainly in Spanish, and also I suspect in other languages, and that is, so, for example, Darren, in right here, I could say to you, why did you wear this jacket, right? I may intend that I'm really trying to get a sense of, like, I like the jacket and I want to know why you're wearing this jacket, right? Because I might want to get one. But when we are in a situation of conflict or tension, people have a predisposition to interpret whatever is said in probably the most negative way possible. We just, that's sort of how human beings operate. And so, if there's any sort of potential for interpretation in the question that begins with why, it will usually be experienced as an accusation. So why this jacket? It's because, well, there's something wrong with it, right? And I'm implicitly telling you that there's something wrong with it. Why did you come here? Why did you enter this door? Why are you driving that car, etc.? It can't be heard any other way besides an accusation. And so the work of the question is, well, I need more information from you. So I should probably ask a question that begins with what or how. What went into your thinking around this jacket? How did you obtain this jacket? As an example, okay. You see what I mean? So why is it's not the rhetorical why that mm-hmm. Allison alluded to. Why does the world exist? It's a different kind of question than why did you come here today, mm-hmm. right? Which can be experienced in a very negative way.
Very interesting. So I'm hearing a couple things about the importance in dialogue, doing dialogue work, participating in dialogue in order for it to be successful or beneficial, have a positive outcome, if you will. That, again, we have to be able to answer and respond to questions in a very dialogical way. But then there's the listening aspect as well. And I'm jumping ahead a little bit in the course, because I know next week, Allison, you touch on listening and the importance of listening. And you talk about in one of your presentations the difference between dialogue and debate, and how there is value in teaching people, young people, how to articulate what they think, how to present an argument, and in the face of a differing opinion. But sometimes listening is not necessarily fostered or is encouraged enough. And I will say, from my own experience, took many debate classes growing up through middle school and high school, learn how to stand up at a podium and tell somebody, this is what I think, and this is why you should think it as well, and what that person thinks is wrong and flawed. And you don't spend a lot of time learning how to listen. So we learn how to speak and make an argument, not how to listen. So how do you go about... Yeah.
Can I make a friendly amendment to that?
Sure.
I would say that in those debate courses that you took, you were being taught how to listen, but with a particular focus. Right?
Yes, yes.
You were learning to listen for weakness as opposed to listening for understanding, which is a dramatic change in paradigm, right? So you were learning to listen, because if you didn't listen to what your opponent was saying, you can't win a debate.
This is true.
So it's really that one shift of what you're listening is about.
Interesting. I want to touch on something else that you mentioned this week in the course, Allison, which is this concept of suspension. And I think this is something that's difficult for people to grapple with, particularly when you're talking about issues of identity or race or class, contentious issues that people feel very strongly about. And so I was hoping that you could, both of you could touch a little bit more on what this idea of suspension is in dialogue and how you do that. And I'd like to preface it with, because I've been introduced to this idea many years ago in a dialogue class that I took, and I came up with this analogy, and you can let me know if you think it, okay. if it works. So I imagined people going into some type of like Colosseum. So people are gathering, and normally we think Colosseum, warriors come in, they've got their swords and they've got their shields. And in a debate, you know, metaphorically speaking, our swords and our shields are our opinions and our perspectives. And I use it to try and defeat somebody else's sword and somebody else's shield. And I use my shield to defend against what other people think. Mm-hmm. And so they fight and they duke it out and someone will end up winning. People cheer and all that kind of stuff. But in dialogue and with this idea of suspension, the image changes for me where, yes, you have warriors that come into the Colosseum. They still have their swords. They still have their shields. We have our opinions and our perspectives. But instead of using it to defeat the other person, we take our weapons, we take our shields, we lay them down on the ground, and then we walk around and see what other people's swords and shields are and say, wow, that's really interesting insignia, or wow, you have a different style sword or handle. But so we're understanding the, quote, weapons that we have, but we're not using them to defeat each other. So the suspension is the process, I would say, of kind of putting down those weapons. So they're still ours. I have pride in them, but I'm not using them to attack somebody else or defend against somebody else's attack. Does that metaphor work for you? Have I like gotten this idea of suspension, or is there more to it than this wacky metaphor?
So to follow the violent metaphor.
Yes.
I do think that there is something to the idea of people struggle with the notion of suspension as though somehow I'm undermining my own sense of identity or belief if I suspend it. And so I think we could all come up with a different metaphor, but it works enough for me that I understand what you're trying to say. The piece that I have found that people really struggle with is the notion of, if I even put down my sword and shield, mm-hmm. to follow your metaphor, I'm somehow saying something about myself in doing that. And so that I can't put down my sword and shield because it means that I'm disconnected from them. That I don't know who mm-hmm. I am without them. And I have found that the people who struggle the most with this idea of suspending judgment or suspending belief, they're usually rooted in a sense of a loss somehow. Like, it helps me define who I am. It helps me define who my people are. It helps me understand my place in the world. It helps me understand right from wrong. And to suspend it is to somehow undermine myself, to do injury to myself. There exists, and I don't mean this in a religious sense, but there's a leap of faith, mm-hmm. right, around this suspension experience, where if I, for the moment, take my beliefs and put them in my pocket, if you will, and engage with you as though they're not gone, they're still a part of me, but I'm going to engage with you as though you still have something to tell me, mm-hmm. right? That's what I like to you. So my metaphor is putting it in your pocket as opposed to being in between us, so that when you have something to tell me, it's as close as you intend it is how I'm going to experience it, as opposed to it having to move through the filter of my understanding, so that if anything comes through, it's only in the way that I want to receive it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's really helpful. Thank you. We have a question and comment from one of our listeners.
Yeah. Denson Staples writes in, one challenge I've had during my involvement with dialogue initiatives is bringing a broad array of experiences to the room. For example, dialogue can sometimes be self-reflective, with people who care most about diversity and equity issues more willing to participate in dialogue than those who are uninterested in diversity. Likewise, my experience has shown that traditionally disempowered or marginalized groups are much more willing to participate in dialogue than individuals who bear identities that are traditionally empowered. What techniques or methods can the speaker share to bring a broad array of individuals to dialogue to enrich the dialogue experience with a diversity of life experiences?
Well, there's the obvious answer of the university, but then I'll extrapolate that to a larger setting. in the university, we realized we were having the same problem when intergroup dialogues weren't offered credit, right? When you don't offer credit, who shows up? The people that care, right? So we said we need to offer credit because what will happen is it will attract people who may not care at all about diversity, but they need that credit, right? And in fact, the diversity of the room tends to be different, particularly as credit is offered, because you attract people who need to graduate but don't really care about the issue. And that's how diversity is built in the room. So what does that mean? It means incentivizing, right? The very definition of inequity and power differentials is that the people with power or people with dominant identities don't have to care. That's the problem, right? And so we can't solve the problem by decreeing it different. It means that we have to incentivize participation. And that might look different in different contexts. It might be money. It might be status. It might be something else. But we have to attend to the fact that oftentimes we have to pay attention to incentives. We also learned that there's a point in time where you have to name the dominant identity for it to even be seen as relevant. Let me give you an example. When we first offered intergroup dialogues, they were called things like a dialogue on race or a dialogue on gender or sexuality, as an example. Who showed up? People whose salient identity is race or gender, meaning people of color, women, or people who are trans, as examples. When we named dialogue that actually named the dominant identity as well, so men, women, et cetera, right, or white people of color, then we attracted a different group of people just because there's a perception of those diversity issues are about those people on the margins. When you name it differently, you attract a different group of people.
So I want to add to that and talk about my personal experience is actually quite interesting, tied to the University of Maryland. I predominantly have facilitated dialogues at Maryland around race or gender. And I will say that my experience has been very different in the two. So in the dialogues around race and ethnicity, it is the marginalized group that has spoken, consistently spoken more. However, in the dialogue around men, women, it is the men who have consistently, and I don't know if you can speak to that, Mark, and have shared a similar experience.
I have.
Men who have spoken more. And so I think that that's something worth looking into and exploring more, but it's just to problematize this notion that it's the marginalized group that goes to a subject and speaks to it. And what does it say? You know, there are a lot of questions around that. What happens, and there are a lot of things that you can do in a dialogue space to ensure that many voices are heard. You can't set a path for any one individual and make them feel safe or comfortable or ready to participate and engage. But what you can do is provide opportunities that what I found, and this draws on my background as an English language teacher, is that people are much more comfortable getting to know one another and share personal experiences early on when they're in pairs or small groups. And so we will invite people to do that. You don't always have to share and open up to a group of 15 people. People can share and learn from one another in many ways. And so providing those smaller group experiences and the feedback that I get from participants is that they really appreciate those moments because they're more comfortable.
We have just about five more minutes left today with our guests. And I'd like to take that opportunity to hear from both of you, what are the top two resources that you would like to share with our listeners if they wanted to learn more about dialogue, whether participating in dialogues, where would they go about doing that, learning more about the history of dialogue or the skills to be a facilitator of dialogue? What would be two resources, again, film, video, books, whatever organizations that you would direct people towards?
A book that I would suggest, it's actually it's one of the staples in the field now, is a book I think it's literally just called Intergroup Dialogue by David Shoem, S-C-H-O-E-M. It's a foundational text, really, really good, about the specifics of intergroup dialogue in higher education particularly. There's another one that is a more philosophical book called On Dialogue by David Bohm, B-O-H-M. That I also find to be very informative in terms of it it helps me think about how I show up, not just as a participant, but as a facilitator, and what I really expect to happen in the room when I engage in dialogue. I think those are two really excellent resources.
Thank you, mm-hmm. Allison.
And I'll add resources that I've used here at USIP when I've gone into the field to teach dialogue and train people in dialogue. The first is one that's actually on the website or on the course now. It's the IDEA handbook, which is great if you're looking at putting together a dialogue process. It really takes you through your selection of participants, just all of the different stages. And it has some great examples of, in terms of conflict and international conflict, some great examples that people can learn from. So that's up there already. There's also the Public Conversations Project, which is a very different model. And they have some resources that we can put on the course as well that are more like a living room dialogue. So it's a really different conception of it. It's what do you do when you have 2 hours with a group of people? How do you structure it's not necessarily a sustained dialogue. It's how do you structure a 2 hour experience for a group of people coming together in a church or in a living room, or so it's a very different process, and it's just as important, and it's a it's structured, but it's also about, it goes back to this, you know, what are the key questions as a facilitator that you want to ask in the different stages of your 2 hour dialogue. So I'll put that up there as a resource.
And there are other scholars as well who've written extensively, lots of articles by a scholar at the University of Washington in Seattle. His name is Ratnesh Nagda, NAGDA. As well as, I believe she's retired, but Ximena Zuniga from University of Massachusetts at Amherst, another scholar who's written extensively. Sylvia Hurtado, another scholar, written extensively about this. Any of their work is superb and would be a great resource.
So some just concluding thoughts from both of you. I'd love to hear how, if at all, your dialogue work, your diversity work has impacted or changed the way that you relate to people on an interpersonal level. So family, friends, loved ones, how you communicate, how you ask questions, how you listen. Have you noticed a shift in yourself as you've been doing this work about how you communicate with people on a personal level in your own personal life?
Yeah, it's in some ways you find yourself facilitating everywhere, right? I have to resist the urge to do that because sometimes I feel like that isn't always my role. But, you know, whenever you observe a conflict, you find that you're immediately placed in the potential role of a facilitator at the grocery store, at the bank, wherever. And so it does affect the way that I relate to people somehow, sometimes. And I think that for me, it's also made me very careful about my language. Like I know how language can be triggering. And so I've really taken great care to make sure that I don't trigger with language. Mm-hmm.
It definitely has shaped how in the workplace or at home or anywhere, how I engage in conversation. What I actually appreciate most about it is that the struggle that I had in 1998 when I left the Peace Corps, I now feel so much more confident and able to have those difficult conversations that I feel really strongly about with friends or with people that I might have avoided it before because I was too frustrated by the potential outcome. So it's sort of in that those traditional spaces where I'm able to communicate more effectively, but I'm also able to use it for my own personal satisfaction. I can have those conversations that I might have steered clear of that mean something to me.
Well, thanks to both of you for sharing your expertise and your stories. This brings us to the end of our show. You have been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate and dialogue about building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. We've been joined in the studio today by Dr. Allison Malofsky. She's Director of Curriculum and Training Design here at USIP, and Dr. Mark Brimhall Vargas, who is Deputy Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Maryland. And thanks to all of our listeners who've been tuning in and those who shared your questions and comments. I have been your host, Darren Cambridge. Our producers are Leah Collins, Vanessa Francis, and Peter Weinberger. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. Our sound engineer is Blake Mobley, who also composed the intro and outro song for this podcast series. Thanks again, and we look forward to having you tune in next week.